We're exploring the remarkable variety of the arts that enriches a thoughtful traveler's time in Ireland today on Travel with Rick Steves. Our focus is the visual arts, and our guides are Roseanne Stringer and Barry Maloney. It's interesting, when you're traveling to Ireland, you kind of have to divide what is Georgian and what is English from the overlords, and what is really indigenous art. All over the place. You go to, even to the West, and Muckross House or something like that. Elegant architecture, but it's English more than Irish, right, Roseanne?
Absolutely.
So if you really want to get indigenous Irish art, what's the glory days of that, and where do you go?
I tell people when I'm traveling out in County Kerry in southwestern Ireland that the single most beautiful building in Ireland is the Galrus Oratory.
To paint a picture for people who haven't been there, it's perfect stonework. Mm. It's like watertight. It's without any mortar, I believe. It's stacked. How many centuries old would you say it is?
It is from around, I think, the year 800.
So it's 1,200 years old. Mm-hmm. It's a church with a nave, and it stands there in the lonely, weather-beaten, godforsaken, westernmost part of Ireland.
And the miracle of it, Rick, is it was built entirely without mortar.
Yeah.
And it's like an upturned boat. It's a miracle, really, that it still stood all those years.
It stood all those years. And that's what Roseanne is talking about. That's where you get this sense of the strength of the artistic and cultural community in Ireland, back when Europe was just rutting in the mud.
Absolutely. And here, this was the sort of centerpiece of a very, very small monastic community that might have held maybe only 15 or 20 members of that community, and one of probably dozens of little monastic sites that are just within a few miles distance from one another on the peninsula.
And then we can get ourselves in this medieval mindset with all the chaos on the continent. The sort of the conscientious objectors of the darkness of the Dark Ages of Europe moved as far west as they could, and then they did what hermit monks like to do. A hermit monk, by definition, just wants to get away from it all. It can be out in the mudflats of Mont Saint-Michel, it could be in a desert somewhere, or it can be on a rock off the coast of Ireland.
True, Rick, out in the Skellig Michael,
yeah,
on the west coast off the Ring of Kerry. Those monks, it's believed, wanted to literally follow the Bible and take the gospel to the ends of the earth and commune with nature.
So in our travels, we can plan to see a lot of these sites from the age of saints and scholars, but also we can remember that Ireland has had a tumultuous 20th century and a terrible struggle with its sectarian issues, and there's a lot of art surviving today on the streets that you'll see.
Well, in Derry and Belfast, you can really walk into history. You can do amazing walking tours up there, but one of the amazing places is to go into the bog site where Bloody Sunday took place in the early 70s. A lot of Irish civil rights campaigners were shot on that day, and to commemorate it, there's these murals, political murals, which tell the story. But they're on the sides of buildings, so they're the size of a building.
Yes, so you've got a positive conclusion coming out of this, but you've got a whole generation of art that is taking symbols of the Catholic and the Protestant side. What symbols do you see on these murals?
Well, just to generalize, in Belfast, you'll really see the divide. So in Belfast, in the nationalist areas, you'll see a lot of green. You'll see a lot of, unfortunately, some terrorist figures wearing balaclavas, holding guns, and, you know, fighting for a free Ireland. Then on the unionist side, you'll see Union Jacks and also masked figures, unfortunately, almost held up as heroes, modern day heroes. But today, things are changing. In Belfast, you'll also see murals depicting the Titanic and the pride of Belfast. One of the best public works you'll see, which, you know, brings the two sides together, is one in Derry called The Hands Across the Divide.
Describe that for us.
It pictures two youngsters, one from the nationalist side, one from the unionist side, reaching out their hands towards each other. And it must be around an inch of space between the two.
And is that a hopeful sign?
Oh, very hopeful. It's showing the peace process and the whole peace in Ireland. I'm sure you've seen that in your visits to Ireland, how things have completely changed. Belfast is becoming, and Derry are becoming the next Killarney, you know?
Really?
And really embracing tourism and embracing their story and history and their future.
Barry and I have had the great pleasure of conversing with two of probably just a handful of mural painters who've been working for decades in the Bogside. Yes, we see
scenes of violence.
Wait a minute.
Where's the Bogside?
The Bogside is in the city center of Derry, or it's in within.
So this is a very hard-fought town during the struggles, during the Troubles.
This was the flashpoint.
The flashpoint. And you've been talking to mural artists who were painting highly politicized wall murals.
Yes.
And now what is their outlook?
Well, they have even personally embraced the idea of reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
So you see Mother Teresa and John Hume and Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King as symbols that really promote peace. And I'm not saying that their earlier work is meant to incite any kind of anger or resistance. They wanted to capture for all time those vivid and horrific images because the story needed to be told. But I think it's very powerful now that they're drawing on Martin Luther King and Mother Teresa as symbols of the hope for the future.
So they've gone from Che Guevara and Geronimo to Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi. That's very hopeful.
Yes.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been exploring Irish art with Barry Maloney and Roseanne Stringer. I'd like you each to share one piece of advice to help people better appreciate the art and through that better appreciate the Irish people. Roseanne?
My favorite object is the Arda Chalice, which dates from around the year 700 in the National Museum of Ireland. And I love it for the simplicity of the design, but the fact that it incorporates what is an iconic knot pattern that we see in a variety of different styles in Irish art, which signifies eternity and continuity.
The name of that chalice again?
Arda, A-R-D-A-G-H.
Beautiful. Barry?
My favorite work is by Jack B. Yeats, the brother of William Butler Yeats. It's a modern work, expressionistic. It's kind of the colors are flowing, and it's called The Liffey Swim. It's a picture, a simple subject. It's showing people swimming in the Liffey.
The Liffey River.
Liffey River, the main river in Dublin City. And what I love most about it is the blues, the rich, dark blues of the sea and the river, and also the light, bright blue in the sky. The way it goes from the dark blue at the base in the Liffey up to the sky, looking towards the future. This is where Ireland is right now, and our art expresses that. We're looking towards the future.
It's a hopeful time when you can stop being burdened by the past and look to a hopeful future.
Very positive time.
Barry Maloney, Roseanne Stringer, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
We've got a little extra time on today's Travel with Rick Steves to check in with listeners who've contacted us recently at 877-333-7425. Or by email at radio@ricksteves.com. Tell us about a kindness you've found in your travels abroad. Sometimes it's the little acts of friendship that make for the very best souvenirs from our travels. Jenny's on the line in Carthage, Missouri. Jenny, thanks for your call.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
You have some memory of some kindness of strangers that you've enjoyed in your travels.
Yes, I do. My husband and I had the opportunity to travel to Denmark in the early 1980s, so this is quite some time ago. Being young and very brave, we decided to rent a car and drive ourselves, and we took a ferry from one point to another. As we got on the ferry and began our journey, we realized that there was no one on the whole ferry that spoke any English, and we did not know any Danish. And so we're making our way with gestures and holding out the money and letting them take the appropriate coins and things like that. And the people were very kind to us, but my fond memory is that there was a cafeteria where you would go through a cafeteria line that's very familiar to all of us and choose your food items and your drink items, and then there were tables and people sat and ate. And as I was going through the cafeteria line, I put a bottle of bottled water on my tray, and someone, without any words whatsoever, just slipped an empty glass onto my tray. And I've always assumed that that person did not want me to embarrass myself by drinking from the bottle.
That's so sweet.
That is my memory.
That's so low-key and thoughtful, and just, here, use a glass, okay?
Yeah. Here's a glass. This is what you need.
I love it when people save you from being kind of gross in a foreign culture, and they just kind of go, oh, no, we do it this way here.
Yep, they do. They do. We also enjoyed on that trip watching a child who was probably six eating her hamburger with her knife and fork because the Danes were eating sandwiches with knives and forks.
Everything is very orderly in Denmark. You feel like you live in a jukebox, you know?
Yeah, yes, they are very orderly. And we had a very funny memory of people at the hotel trying to eat cornflakes with a fork who were unfamiliar with cornflakes
at
breakfast. So it's fun to observe these.
And I got to turn it around and teach my little cousin in Norway how to use chopsticks. He had never before seen or used chopsticks. And that was striking to me because that's so commonplace here in the United States. But
Where you live, in the Northwest.
Yeah, that's right.
Here in Missouri, not so much.
Not so much, huh? Okay, well, we all have our different exposures, don't we?
Yes. Sure.
You could save me from being gross if I ever come down to Missouri by making cultural faux pas.
Here, we would probably take you for a barbecue, and you simply need a good supply of napkins.
Yeah, I bet. Well, that's probably the mark of a good barbecue.
Yep. The other thing that I wanted to say and the story that I wanted to relate is actually much more important to my family and myself. I have been a student of family history for almost 30 years now, trying to find where my relatives have come from to America through many connections and the kindness of a history teacher in the Czech Republic. We have been able to visit the actual home where my immigrant family left from to come to the United States about 140 years ago. And the strangers who live in this house now invited us in for tea.
Whoa.
And were just delightful. And we visited in 2006. And then we were able to visit again in 2009. Again, they insisted when they heard that we were coming back that we come again for some tea and
now, this is a small town in the Czech Republic?
Small town, Dušejov, small town about 70 miles east and a little south of Prague. Very impressed as I record the movement of my Czech family who came first to Wisconsin, then down to Kansas, and eventually homesteaded in Oklahoma, where I was born. And the numbers of Czechs who came because of the great strife that they've had in their country over time. And when we visited in 2006, they were very eager to ask us about our opinions of how they were doing after their Velvet Revolution, and very pleased with the freedom that they had.
Oh.
So probably the immigration out of their country has been great over time because they've had so much oppression.
Although I've had friends in the Czech Republic tell me that fewer of them emigrate than from their neighboring countries because they just cannot imagine not being next to the beer that is so good made right there.
The real Budweiser.
The Budweiser.
The real Budweiser.
They don't want to leave that. It's just never quite as good as getting that in the Czech Republic.
Right. And this impression that I had when we visited was that I felt very much at home, and people revere other people so much. And people who were not in our family line precisely, but who were friends and neighbors and who were from this small village, would cry when they saw us and when we came to visit them. They were so touched that we had come from America to see the homeland. Mm. And the homeland is very important.
Yeah.
Very important. And I really had this sense of belonging there, even though I'd never been there.
How long ago did your family leave that town in the Czech Republic?
140 years ago, 1867.
Isn't that beautiful that you've got that connection and now you can go back there and feel that connection with the people who live in your family home 140 years later?
Isn't that something?
That's great. Jenny, thank you so much for your call.
You're very welcome. Take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And Maggie's on the line in Mount Airy, Maryland. Maggie, thanks for your call.
Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it.
You bet. You had an interesting 9/11 experience.
I did. Back in 2001, a few months after I moved from Manhattan to Houston, I found myself in Tokyo for business. And late one night, alone in my hotel room, watching CNN, that's where I saw the Trade Towers go down. And on the 12th, the office where I was working closed, and State Department advised all of us, that the Americans that were there, they suggested that we avoid known American hangouts. So feeling a bit helpless and fretful, I set out to distract myself by seeing the city. So I wandered around until I came to Sensoji Temple. And Sensoji is a rather sprawling compound with various statues and offering sites. And when I made it to the main hall, I paused because I was trying to figure out how the offering for a fortune kind of worked, when this older Japanese gentleman came up with a really big smile and he came up to help me. So I pulled the paper scroll out and he translated for me that I had gotten a small fortune. And he told me that was a very good fortune. Big fortune is better, he said, but small fortune is very good, very good. And he asked me, just out of regular course, he asked me where I was from. And when I explained that I had recently moved to Texas from New York City, he took my hand and he looked in my eyes very caringly and he said, "I'm so sorry to hear what's happened to your country." And without much thought on it, I said, "Thank you," and I asked him where he was from. And he said, "I'm from Nagasaki." And I hesitated a bit in with his response, and I returned his look, and I said, "You know, I'm so sorry with what Nagasaki went through." And from that point forward, he hung with me. You know, he walked with me through the temple grounds, and he told me that he was a young boy in Nagasaki during the bombing, and that afterwards, you know, he described that many people got sick and some died, and he said it was not very good. But he did say that the end of the war was a very good thing. And as I was talking to him, I had to ask him how he come to speak English so well. And it turned out he had studied in the U.S. on a post-war student exchange, and he had visited somewhat small, obscure southern towns mostly, including a stop in Texas, a small town in Texas, where he told me he experienced, of all things, chip flipping. You know, that creative and entertaining activity with cow poop.
Oh, yeah.
So he was just a delightful man. He's a spry older gentleman, just delightful. And he spent a fair bit of time with me. We walked around the city, went on a river tour, and he pointed out different sites, which I remember many of the sites, but really it's his stories that I remember. And you know, to this day, I hold a great deal of fondness for this experience and for this gentleman from Nagasaki.
He lived through the atomic bombing of Nagasaki.
He did.
And they lost 80,000 people on that day.
My goodness.
80,000. We lost 3,000, tragic, on 9/11. But he could really comfort somebody who had been, you know, from a town that was also hit very strong. Wow.
I mean, I'm so grateful. And it was for the distraction, but it was also, you know, he gave me a bit of hope that, you know, there's wonderful human things that come out of great tragedy. And he was just a wonderful presence. We talked a little bit about what it was like for him in Nagasaki, and I talked a little bit about who I was worried about back at home. But it was really just the genuineness of him, you know, just being this delightful man. It was quite wonderful.
Well, Maggie, as we think back on 9/11, thank you very much for sharing your experience on September 11, 2001 in Tokyo.
Well, thank you very much for letting me share.
Okay, bye now.
Take care.
Bye. Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton with Sarah McCormick. Rick has also voiced guided walking tours to many of Europe's most popular sites. Look for the Rick Steves Audio Europe package on iTunes and at ricksteves.com. Join us again next week for more Travel with Rick Steves.
Travel with Rick Steves is made possible in part by the European Union delegation to the USA. Tips about traveling in Europe and information about the EU are available at euintheus.org.